It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, we'll look at how peregrine falcons, once virtually extinct in Wisconsin, are doing across the state and how their nesting season is going so far.
First, President Barack Obama announced today that his administration will ban the sale of certain military-style equipment to local police departments. Banned items include tracked armored vehicles, bayonets, grenade launchers, high-caliber weapons and ammunition, and camouflage uniforms. Other kinds of gear will be sold only if local police give extra assurances that they would be used responsibly and tracked their use. Pundits say this ban is part of the president's effort to ease tensions between minority communities and law enforcement in reaction to the tragic events in Baltimore, Maryland, Ferguson, Missouri, and other cities around the country.
Here to talk about this action and what it could mean for community police relations is Cami Chavis Simmons. She's a professor of law and director of the criminal justice program at Wake Forest University. Cami, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, this thing on military equipment for police departments, as we said, part of a bigger effort to bridge the gap between police and especially minority communities. Does this equipment, does banning these sales help do that, do you think?
I think it could have a significant impact. Certainly, it won't be the only thing needed in order to rebuild some of the trust, I think, that's been damaged, quite frankly, damaged over many years, but what we've seen recently. I think that if you look back at Ferguson last summer and what happened there and the use of that equipment actually exacerbated some of the situations on the ground when you had people who were peacefully protesting and they were met with that type of equipment. So I think it's a significant step, but it won't be the only thing needed.
Right. I think a lot of people are worried about what they call in politics the optics of the situation, especially in Ferguson, that you had people who looked more like a military than a police department. Does that send a message to say, hey, we don't want this showing up at public protests?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when you have police department responding with tanks and assault rifles, I think the constant refrain that you heard was, you know, these images, this doesn't look like America. This doesn't look like America. This is all part of, I think, the impetus, really, is the realization that police officers should be seen as guardians rather than occupying forces in the communities that they serve.
Now, looking at the specific items that police departments can't get with any federal help anyway, tracked armored vehicles, things that the layperson might call tanks or look like tanks, bayonets, grenade launchers, high-caliber weapons and ammunition, and camouflage uniforms. Do you think it's right to out and out say no sales of this federal equipment using federal funds to police departments? Does that ban make sense?
I think that the ban is appropriate. I mean, when I was looking over the list, particularly I'm thinking about bayonets. We just don't in our these are weapons that are more appropriate for a battlefield, right? Rather than just keeping our cities safe. Sometimes you will hear, and I have heard, and I've spoken with police chiefs across the country who feel like, well, you know, we need some of this equipment. We want to be prepared if there is something of a very violent nature that occurs. I think that President Obama's plan, however, is to have where some of this equipment that has not been banned can be used with very strict guidelines in place. So I think that that's another significant improvement here, is that the material that will be available, that still can be available, will be so only with strict guidelines, and then we will empirically track or study the use of it. So there's some accountability added there.
Talking to Cami Chavis Simmons with Wake Forest University, looking at an announcement today by the president banning the use of federal funds to buy a certain list of military-style equipment for police departments, and as she just mentioned, restrictions, accountability, the goal for other types of military equipment. Now, Cami, this announcement coincides with the release of a report from a police task force that President Obama formed last year after what happened in Ferguson. I'm going to quote from the report. It wants law enforcement agencies to, quote, embrace a guardian rather than a warrior mindset to build trust and legitimacy both within the agencies and with the public. What do you make of that part of the conclusion?
Yes, I think that, as I said earlier, the trust has really deteriorated. Many communities of color feeling disproportionately affected by the use of this equipment. You know, if someone's having a peaceful protest, why is it that you see these types of tanks or certain weapons deployed? So I think that, again, hopefully this is a step in the right direction. I think in order also to build trust and legitimacy, perhaps more emphasis, more money should be given for training and hiring police officers who have the capabilities to deal effectively with citizens and problem solve.
Now, Ferguson is what started this conversation in a lot of ways. We already talked about how, in response to protests, a lot of this military-style equipment was rolled out. Let's move to a more recent case, what happened in Baltimore recently after the funeral of a man involved in a police-involved death. How did military-style gear, if at all, come into play in those protests and the riots in Baltimore?
Interesting about this is, and of course, there was a lot of criticism, I think, from a lot of criticism for the local officials and how they handled the situation in Baltimore and how some of the violence and rioting was out of hand, really, because there was no deployment of this type of equipment. You saw the National Guard, and when the National Guard came in, they indeed came in with heavy weapons, and we saw, you know, armored trucks and that type of thing. So it's a double-edged sword. There's a balance, in my opinion. I don't think that having that type of heavy-handed equipment on the ground in the beginning would necessarily have been more more effective.
Do you think there's a worry from police departments that they can't win if they bring out the heavy gear? They're criticized for that. If they don't, they're criticized for letting things get out of hand?
Yeah, I certainly think there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking happening with respect to that. You know, it's each situation is different, and situations unfold differently, and it's just very important to have a number of strategies and tactics at the disposal of the police department. I think that it's not troubling to me some of the things that have been outright banned, bayonets, for example, the high-powered artillery. I think that in this country we've been able to keep public order without the use of those in our cities.
Now, these issues we talk about from Ferguson to Baltimore and points in between over the last year, in some ways, these are things really specific to the communities they happened in. So do you think something like this and the announcements that came out today at the federal level are going to help all these particular individual community situations?
I think that the federal government is doing its rightful job by setting a standard. I think that local communities should be able to deal with their issues and create policies that are best for their municipalities, but they need to do so with a baseline. And what the federal government has said here today is, look, this baseline is we're just not going to provide certain types of equipment. And for certain equipment, we want to make sure that there are guidelines in place. I think that sometimes if officers or police departments have too much discretion and it's not curtailed by strict guidelines, then that's when things get out of hand. And they need to be able to develop those guidelines but operate with some accountability.
Cammie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Cammie Chavis-Simmons, professor of law and director of the criminal justice program at Wake Forest University. She was with us to talk about the president's announcement today that he'll ban the sale of some federal military-style equipment to local police departments.
It's nesting season for peregrine falcons here in Wisconsin. That means webcams are popping up around the state so you can watch these birds as they go about raising their newborn chicks. And while that's pretty cool in and of itself, it's especially remarkable when you consider that these birds were completely wiped out here in Wisconsin at one point.
No peregrines are believed to have lived in Wisconsin from 1965 to 1987 after damage done by DDT. Since then, our next guest has been working tirelessly on falcon recovery efforts across the state. state, and it's been paying off. Greg Septon is with us. He's a Peregrine Falcon manager, and he's been working for over two decades on these recovery programs. Greg, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So what's the current state of Peregrine Falcons here in Wisconsin?
Peregrines are actually doing fairly well here in Wisconsin, but having said that, I want to make note of the point that most of these birds are nesting in urban areas on human-built structures. Last year, for example, we had a known total of 31 nests that produced a total of 97 young, but only four of those nest sites were on cliffs. So a lot of these birds have not gone back and restored native sites as quickly as we'd hoped. So very frankly, some of the cities today offer these birds an environment that wasn't here 100 years ago that suits them just fine.
Now, reading up on this, it sounds like the process of sort of seeding these nesting sites is called hacking. Is it possible that these birds are just not going to go back to the wild, but they're going to be more urban phenomenon from here on out?
I think you're going to have both. I think you're going to have peregrine falcons reoccupying cliffs along the river, the Mississippi River in particular, and they have been doing that. They've met with some problems with raccoon, predation by raccoons and so on. But again, we have more suitable habitat today across a good portion of this country in our cities. I mean, if you stop for a second and consider the sheer number of tall buildings in cities like Chicago and Detroit and Minneapolis, St. Paul, and of course here in Milwaukee, a lot of those buildings offer nest sites for peregrines. And again, that's an environment there, or a habitat that wasn't here 100 years ago.
Is it a similar story across the nation as it is in Wisconsin, this drastic decline and then reintroduction mostly in cities so far?
Well, yes and no. If you stop for a minute, take a look at what's been going on out on the West Coast, the California, Grand Canyon areas, the Rocky Mountains, of course. Those peregrines have all returned to their historical eyries in the mountains and along the cliffs along the Pacific Ocean and also along the Colorado River. Those populations have been restored. But you need to stop for a minute and consider the fact that there are no very large cities close to those areas either. So those are the mainstay for peregrines in those areas. But when you get east of the Mississippi River, we've built up the environment pretty intensively, and there's a lot of concrete here that wasn't here. And again, the falcons have adapted to that. So if all we have remaining here in the upper Midwest were the cliffs they nested on historically, that's probably the only places they would be nesting. But again, we have newly created habitat that they've adapted to, and they're doing very well.
Now, sounds like post-1965, thanks to DDT, that they were wiped out totally from Wisconsin for a while. What's the history of them since then?
We began a recovery program for peregrines in Wisconsin in 1987 in a similar manner to other states here in the upper Midwest. So it was a regional effort, a regional Midwest effort. And over a 4 or 5 year period, I believe we released 103 captive-produced peregrines here in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, Pleasant Prairie, Madison, La Crosse, and Racine. And those captive-produced birds joined the other captive-produced young that had been released in other states, and they became the foundation, basically, of the population we have here today. These are all the birds we have here today are offspring and progeny and relatives to the initial captive-produced birds we released back in the 80s and early 90s.
Now, you've put a lot of time and energy into peregrines and bringing them back to Wisconsin. What is it about the bird that you find remarkable?
They're at the top of the food chain. They're the stealth fighters of the bird world. There's nothing faster. And seeing one in a classic stoop or a dive where they can achieve speeds of well over 200 miles an hour, it's pretty awe-inspiring. It's something that you don't get a chance to see very often. And when you do, it stirs your soul. I mean, it's something that's pretty spectacular. And the peregrines themselves are pretty amazing birds. I mean, I'll give you an instance. We had a situation here in Milwaukee last week where an adult male at a nest site was injured. And because he had four young to care for, the males do all the hunting when the females are incubating and brooding their young for the first 10 days or so. So he wasn't able to provide food. So to lessen the load at that particular site, I took two of the young from that nest and put them into another nest site where the eggs had failed to hatch due to a problem with an intruding female that showed up. And long story short, both young at both sites are doing very, very well. But my point here was that when I opened the back of the box on the nest box, the back door on the nest box at the power plant where I was bringing these two chicks, both adult falcons were sitting on the front of the box, probably 24 inches away, When I took the two young falcons and placed them in the nest box, the adult female actually jumped down off the deck and brooded the two young immediately as I was withdrawing my hand. And just seeing things like that, I mean, getting an opportunity to see that, I mean, that just blows people away and blew me away.
Yeah, that's amazing. And also amazing, you said they can fly up to 200 miles an hour. What does that look like to see when they're swooping in on something?
It's like grease lightning. It's a stoop. It's a power dive, basically. They'll go quite high in the air, and they'll spot prey, and they'll do a rollover, and they'll make three or four very quick wing flaps, and it sets them into a trajectory course towards their prey. And again, it happens very, very quickly. It's very, very fast. And again, all was spectacular.
We're talking to falcon recovery expert Greg Septon about efforts to bring peregrine falcons back to Wisconsin. By the way, we've got a link to a webcam right now at the Central Time Facebook page. Our producer, Chris Molina, is watching it right now. He says Mama Bird is hanging out with the chicks. So Central Time Facebook page to get a look at that. We also have the call of a peregrine falcon queued up here. Let's take a listen. Sounds like a peregrine and a friend there. Greg, what are you hearing? I assume there's a variety of calls for the peregrine?
That's a cacking call or an alarm call, and what it sounded like I heard there was an adult cacking and some youngs joining in the chorus, maybe at a nest box or a nest site.
And are there other calls? You know, you have that raptor sort of sound that you hear from a lot of hawks and eagles. Do the falcons have a similar thing?
You'll hear a scream occasionally, but another call they make is called an e-chip or an e-chip call. It's a recognition call. And you'll see falcons when they see you at a nest site, in particular in the spring, you'll see the adults calling back and forth to each other using that call.
Now, we've talked about how they move, what their nesting habits are like, but what do they look like?
They're about a crow-sized bird. They have a wingspan of about 30 to 36 inches. The males are about a third smaller than the female. The adults have a beautiful powdery blue slate-gray back with a black and white barred breast, dark charcoal-colored head, dark brown eyes, bright chrome yellow, sear that fleshy area where their nostrils are above the beak, and eyelids. They're quite striking.
Now, DDT, as we mentioned, was the main reason that the peregrines disappeared from Wisconsin. The DDT is gone. They seem to be coming back. But what are some of the biggest threats? What are some of the biggest roadblocks to the reintroduction here in Wisconsin?
Roadblocks, I guess, early on, some of the captive-produced birds ended up getting hit by cars. Some flew into windows. And having said that, 50 to 70% of all young peregrines, like most raptors, don't make it through their first year. The first-year mortality rate for birds of prey is quite high, and it's nature's way of sorting things out so the best genes are passed on for the following generations. But we've had peregrines that have flown into wires. We've had them hit by cars. We've had them poisoned. We've actually had three that have been shot here in Wisconsin in the last year, which was just really alarming. All three were in cities, so someone was out there shooting at these birds. So then there's a number of different ways that they can find their demise.
Now, it sounds as though it took scientists a long time to figure out that DDT was the culprit for these fragile eggs that were decimating the peregrine falcon population. Why did it take so long?
Well, no one really knew what was causing the problem, and it took scientists to go out and actually collect eggshells, and then they also went about in both England and here in the U.S., and measuring shells from the eggshell collection, bird egg collections in museums across the country. And by measuring the thickness of the eggshells, they determined that the eggshell thinning was the cause of the decline. And then doing chemical analysis, they found out that DDT was the culprit. So it didn't kill the birds outright. It caused the eggs to form very thin shells, which broke under the females during incubation.
Now, looking at their diet and habitat today, I can imagine in the wild, if they'd move back into the cliffs, a lot of food there. What are they eating in the cities? Are there enough mice to sustain them?
First, as far as the peregrines are concerned, the cities are the wilds. They're wild. These are wild birds, whether they're living in the cities or living along the rivers. They're all the same bird. But in the cities, their prey, it's pretty close to what you're going to find nesting on the cliffs. I did a survey a number of years ago monitoring 19 urban peregrine nest sites for a period of 6 years. And during that time, I identified 107 different bird species that peregrines had taken in cities So they take a lot of different birds. The top 10 I have is blue jay, pigeon, grackle, red-winged blackbird, woodcock, sorrel rail, yellow-billed cuckoo. I can't remember the rest of them. But anyway, there's a top 10, and all these species are quite common. And a lot of these peregrine nest sites today in cities are also along lake shores, like the Lake Michigan shoreline here in Wisconsin, as well as Illinois down the Chicago region. So a lot of these urban peregrines prey on the migratory birds that also utilize that same flyway.
And we leave it there. I hope a lot of people have luck watching these wonderful birds on these webcams. We've got a link to one up on the Central Time Facebook page. Greg, thank you so much for joining us.
Again, my pleasure.
That was falcon expert Greg Sefton. He joined us to talk about the comeback of peregrine falcons in Wisconsin and this year's nesting season.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. A study by researchers from Princeton and Stanford has concluded that politics is now the biggest divider in America and is more divisive than race or religion.
The causes, maybe it's just that we feel like it's okay to hate our political opponents. Maybe it's a lack of unifying events in the U.S., but whatever the cause, it does seem like a very fractured time for partisan politics.
Paul Fanlon is the editor of the Capital Times, where he wrote about that issue. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Well, Paul, you say in your piece that we might be at the point where hate might be the right word to describe our partisan divide. Is it really that bad?
Well, it seems that it is. I've obviously been writing about, and as my staff has, about the partisan divide in Wisconsin over the last few years, and Wisconsin is something of a microcosm for the national political divide. But the column actually grew from a headline I'd seen on a column in the Washington Post around the actual use of the word hatred that went beyond the words like hostility, resentment, animosity, acrimony, and other things that had been used and seemed to get to hate. And in your introduction, you talked about the study and how, in contrast to talking about race, which is not a particularly safe subject to deal with, talking about partisanship and talking about political opponents is a safe place to express very strong feelings. And an awful lot's been written about the topic, but it certainly seems to be strong in Wisconsin these days.
Now, you're right that, hate in its many guises is becoming increasingly unacceptable for the better, but it seems as though in politics it's one area where it's still sort of open season to express those strong feelings you're talking about. Why is that?
Well, I think I was telling you before we came on air that I've gotten some strong negative responses to this column saying that I'm talking about hate in politics when my columns are filled with right-wing people think hate from the left. I think looking at it historically, and I made this point before that I've been following Wisconsin politics for 30 or 35 years, that really starting in about with Barack Obama's election in 2008 and the creation of the Tea Party in 2009 and Governor Walker's election in 2010 has taken us to a different level, the level that continues until today. I think one of the striking things is Governor Walker's talking to Republicans and seeking primary support, talking about what he's accomplished in Wisconsin. And he's won three elections, he points out. He's never won by gotten more than 53% of the vote. To my mind and the mind of most people who are opposed to his policies, there's a strong feeling of disenfranchisement among people on the left or even in the political center. And I think that's really fostered this sort of cycle of ill feelings that borders on hatred. Before I came over today, I looked at Tommy Thompson's record, and I covered Governor Thompson before he was elected governor, and he got elected in 1986 for the first time with a margin that was similar to Governor Walker's, but then as he moved through the years, he actually got 67% of the vote, which showed that he wanted to be the governor of all of Wisconsin, and I think that's the primary reason of this divisiveness, and And I think that's where we are today.
Now, you use the word disenfranchisement as a driving force of the partisan politics that we're seeing in the state right now. I'm not talking about Washington as a whole, but can you take that and extrapolate out? I mean, is it really the case that certain segments of the population don't feel they're being representative, and that's what you think is at the cause of this?
I think in Wisconsin it is. I was talking to Barbara Lawton, the former lieutenant governor, yesterday, and she was talking about early in the administration of Governor Doyle, when the Democrats controlled both houses of the legislature. Certainly there was a Democratic agenda, but it wasn't a sort of my way or the highway kind of approach that we've seen over the last few years with the Republicans in power. And now you see it going through to the Supreme Court, with the Supreme Court becoming bitterly partisan races, and the ballot question about the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and all you've done in your reporting about that and had conversations about that. So I think it does flow through. I think from the right, I suppose if I was if I believed in strongly right-wing policies, I think this was all fine, that finally some wave has come in and gotten it right. But I wonder how those right-wing forces would feel were the shoe on the other foot, and policies that seem to me to be out of step with the mainstream middle of Wisconsin would feel from that perspective.
And you're writing about this partisan divide in Wisconsin, which you see as a microcosm of the nation at large. Mm-hmm. This is from a progressive standpoint you're coming from, but aren't you using the same us and them language that you're worried about here?
I think that's a fair criticism, and I've thought about that, and I thought that the disenfranchisement angle is the best defense I have from that. I don't know really what the alternative is if in the last few years, with what progressives perceive as the attack on the public sector, on public education, both at the K-12 and now especially at the university level, with the attacks on environmental regulations, on reproductive choice. It's just seemed that over the years that we've taken whatever the most extreme option is and pursued that, so it's hard to not take that sort of position. I don't really know what the compromise doesn't seem available.
We're talking right now to Paul Fanlon, political reporter and editor of the Capital Times, about the current state of political divide in Wisconsin and Washington at large. Now, going back to Wisconsin, you talked about some of the policies leading to a feeling of disenfranchisement here in Wisconsin. If you look at an issue that Democrats, excuse me, are worried about, you could look at redistricting and say the Republicans have redistricted to their advantage, but yet when the Democrats were in power, they chose to do the same thing. So isn't it just a case of who's ever in power takes the power available, and what we're left with is some people who don't like it on either side?
Again, a fair criticism. I covered the 1980, that's how far back I go, the 1980 redistricting when Democrats had strong control of it. I think that what's happened over time is sort of a gradual intensifying of the partisan orientation around these things. There was a sense that certainly the previous redistricting, which occurs every 10 years, had a strong partisan element to it, but we've taken it sort of to the maximum now, and it's not just redistricting. It's what progressives regard as voter suppression in terms of the voter ID kinds of actions and other sorts of things that seem to be about making political protection and permanency as opposed to the public interest. But again, I would not argue that the Democrats behaved in something of the same way. I just think that everything is more extreme in 2015.
So I guess the question is, what is driving that extremism as you see it? In your piece, you mentioned Ronald Reagan as someone who drew a lot of broad support beyond just the far right, and Tommy Thompson, who did that same thing in Wisconsin. So what then has changed?
Well, I think the influence of money in politics, it seems to drive people apart. In my column, I referenced an interview with a UW-Madison political scientist talking about the caucus system, that the way we choose presidential candidates seems to foster the most extreme kinds of views in order to survive those sort of processes. And that's true with Iowa Republicans at this point. So there have been structural things that have evolved over time that have again fostered this sort of division. I think the media is also, you know, we've talked before on this air about the media disruption the last few years and how now increasingly people seek news sources that sort of fit their master narrative of life. Be that Fox News or the New York Times or the Daily Beast online or whatever. And so we don't really have a common conversation. Again, I'm dating myself, but going back to the Walter Cronkite days of the world, we all listened to sort of the same set of facts and then reacted to them. You know, I thought one of the things in your opening, you mentioned the Princeton study, the Princeton-Stanford study. And one of the things from the column I pulled away is that 30 years ago, people really thought the other side at least meant well. And we seem to be past an era in which we assume that the other side, the people who are actively engaged in politics, thinks the other side's intentions are well meant.
Now, we often talk about politics as being cyclical, not that we go through cut and dried cycles, but there is sort of a pendulum that swings back and forth. Is it possible that you can point to a spot and say, here we are in the pendulum, and the pendulum will swing in the other direction? Or is what we're seeing, to your mind, in your years covering politics, is it more unprecedented?
Well, I think we're at an unprecedented position from where I sit. Maybe if you go back 100 years to before the birth of the progressive movement, you'd see something like this. But I think where we are right now is unprecedented. Although, you know, I write in a column after the one that we're talking about here today that just appeared online today, the amazing pace of same-sex marriage attitudes over the last couple of years. It's just absolutely been astounding to watch how views have changed quickly on that. And one can hope that there could be that kind of momentum on other subjects around racial equality, and also around economic issues. I think that just talking about wealth disparity and saying we ought to tax the rich a lot more is not a good way for progressives to go. But talking about a level playing field is. Talking about a University of Wisconsin system that gives all children, not just the children of the affluent, a fair shake. And that's where things could start to evolve.
We're talking right now to Paul Fanlon, political reporter and editor of the Capital Times, about the current state of political divide in Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you. Are you able to have civil conversations in person or on social media about politics, about political issues, or do they degenerate into a big hate fest of some sort? How do you think we can get back to civil discourse and relationships? What should be the social norms when we talk about politics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking to the Capital Times editor Paul Fanlon right now about the divisive political climate that we have here in Wisconsin and beyond.
And we want to hear your thoughts on how politics in Wisconsin and across the country are working or not working. Do we need new social norms to help us get along when we disagree about politics? Do you see in your personal life or work life, is it impossible to have civil conversations, or does it just degenerate into angry name calling, or do you just avoid the topic altogether with people you disagree with? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And we go to our phones now. We've got Jake on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Jake.
Hi. Yeah, I think this breed of Republican or conservative or whatever you want to call it, reactionary, is beyond any sort of comprehension or beyond any sort of compromise. They came in to rule. And they came in to dictate. And we've seen that in Wisconsin and in Kansas and any other state, that they'll do anything they feel like in order to get their policies pushed. And
Jake, thank you for your call. Appreciate your thoughts there. And is there something different about the time that we live in? Jake suggesting that he's pointing a finger at Republicans in this case, saying that that's the way it is right now and you can't really change anything. Do you agree with that? And would Republicans say the same thing about Democrats right now?
Well, they might. And I've heard a lot of voices from where Jake's coming from. And it's a real conundrum because I don't want the Capital Times, even though we've been a progressive voice for nearly a century, almost 100 years in 2017, to be sort of one tone and screedy and always complaining in our editorial voice. And so we're looking for a sense of thoughtful analysis. And these times make it difficult. It's a constant challenge. I've certainly heard an awful lot of the viewpoint that your Milwaukee caller expressed, and I suspect Republicans, if the next caller is a strident Walker supporter, he or she will take that position.
Now, we talked earlier about your position that politics is sort of one of the last bastions where it's okay to express full-throated, almost hatred of something, a position, maybe even a person, and that there aren't the societal norms to hold that in check. Do you have any suggestions, guidelines that we should be thinking about when we do engage?
Well, that's another great question. I try to do that from time to time, and I think reading, suggesting people read serious news sources, serious analysis, including some from the other side. I try to read the Wall Street Journal's opinion page and its op-ed page to try to understand the thinking on the other side, so at least the conversations can be more thoughtful. And that would be one thing. I was on your air 3 or 4 months ago talking about what we were doing to try to cut off sort of anonymous, precisely anonymous comments on our site, and we haven't missed those, and we've actually encouraged more letter writing in the traditional sense and more op-eds, including opposition from opposition voices, and we run plenty of material that's critical of me or Dave Zweifel or John Nichols or other opinion voices in the Capital Times. So we try to lean towards civility. It is very difficult in this climate.
Now, when you talked to a political scientist here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Barry Burden, you asked him, is there an end in sight? What did he say? Is there an end in sight?
Well, he said he wasn't really sure there was an end in sight. He didn't see one. He talks. It's a popular topic in political science circles. And I keep coming back to history and how different things are now. I think back to 9/11 and the degree to which that was a unifying event in terms of the partisan or lack of partisan response after that. And from where I sit, the continued focus on Benghazi is a polar opposite of that. And I don't know what to say about that. I don't know what I can say to conservative colleagues, conservative friends, that would move the conversation forward on that. I don't understand that in the context of how progressives reacted in the days after 9/11, which was, I thought, under a sense of patriotism and unity.
Well, another opportunity for that common unifying time, which could bring people together, might have been the economic downturn, something that affected lots and lots of people from the top to the bottom in certain cases. But it didn't seem to pan out that way. Why?
Well, I think the blame is shared by the traditional Democratic Party, which Elizabeth Warren wrote about and continues to talk about, which was that the Wall Street influences had great special interests in not having major reforms and in not having things pulled together. So we sort of glided past that without the kinds of changes and the kinds of fundamental conversations that might have helped on that front.
And another issue you raise as a possible solution, long-term again, but maybe campaign finance reform. Is this something that you think has the power to bring people together?
Theoretically, yes. But with the Supreme Court's rulings, recent rulings on First Amendment and free-flowing money, it's hard to imagine exactly how that is going to evolve. Frankly, my biggest hope, and I just read an article on the Political website today, which is about the number of voters who are leaving this earth and are older, and hope that millennials will come at this differently, and not necessarily from a progressive democratic standpoint, but just from a different standpoint, to kind of give us a massive reset in terms of the national psyche without all the baggage of the last 30 or 40 years.
And just briefly, Paul, as we wrap up, if nothing changes, what's the future of politics in America?
Well, I think the thing that I'm most afraid of is the quality of candidate we will get, and then ultimately the quality of the decisions. I'm often bothered when I'm in social settings by people who gripe about local politicians, and I know local politicians, school board members, city council members. It's thankless. It's hard work, and it doesn't really pay. And now in the era of social media and email, these folks work very, very hard. So I'm not all that optimistic about the near-term future. I think the generational change is our greatest hope.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
That was Paul Fanlon, political reporter and editor of the Capital Times, talking about the divisive state of politics in Wisconsin and nationally and where we might be able to go from here. There's an effort today to throw a little love at the museums of the world. It's International Museum Day, celebrated on May 18th each year since 1977.
Well, we wanted to play along, so we're inviting you to share your favorite museum, whether it's here in Wisconsin or anywhere around the world. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR and tell us about your favorite museum and what you like about it. And I've got, I confessed earlier, we've got a really great museum right across the street from our studio that I haven't set foot in 15 years. The Chazen, formerly the Elvium Museum.
Right.
And you swing over there every now and then when you can.
It can be a good palate cleanser when there's time, which there isn't often, but I've taken my kids there. And yeah, it's a lovely museum that I have on my dream list of museums. I've still got the Louvre and the Prado.
And I'm a big fan when I make it to New York, the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I get museum fatigue there, I gotta admit. There's just so much. And by the end, I'm like kind of running around trying to take in as much as I can. But a lot are really great museums around the state here to check out. Maritime Museum, Milwaukee, just packed with them. Kohler up there. Yeah,
right.
Just
lots of good stuff.
Let's
right
take
here
a couple
state.
Weeks off. We're going on a museum tour.
All right,
Central Time Museum Tour. It's happening.